Hello, I'm Kristen Meyer-Shand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast dedicated to the unique culture and local heritage of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. Today, I'm joined by Kathy Chepesky, a member of the Opiongo Readers Theatre. She's here with a very curious local story, perfect for our annual Halloween show. We hope it will put you in the mood for that upcoming ghoulish evening of scary things that go bump in the night, and we hope that what we have to offer you today won't seem too horrific, but we do warn you, if you have any imagination at all, you're about to get the bejeepers scared right out of you. We can't tell you just yet who wrote The Mystery of Skeeds Oak. You'll understand why soon enough. But we can tell you that we received it only last week as a freshly written manuscript stuffed into a brown paper envelope and slipped under our transom. Its author said, "Only Kathy Chepesky can open this envelope and read it to you, because I know Kathy can keep a secret." Apparently, this intrigue all started earlier this month with the Station Keepers MV, the nonprofit group that we here at the Opiongo Line are affiliated with, and who keep the old train station in Barry's Bay open for business as a shining icon of our local heritage and unique culture. Well, at the beginning of each month, Station Keepers members get a digital newsletter called the Spare Board, emailed to them. It has all sorts of interesting things in it, everything from notices about upcoming local cultural events to a curious collection of old photographs and ancient newspaper clippings of local interest from years gone by. So, a few weeks ago, what should the Spare Board contain but a very short old news clipping from the Chicago Tribune, dated February 21st, 1873. It read, "One of the party which lynched a man at Skeed's lumber shanties in Hastings has made a confession and says the man was tried by 12 of his comrades and condemned to death and was hung to a tree." Shocking as that may sound, many local historians know that until the 1870s, the land just west of Barry's Bay was part of Hastings County, and it was there, at Bark Lake, that James and Robert Skeed originally set up their first timber shanty in the 1840s. Then, just last week, we received this story, The Mystery of Skeed's Oak, that only Kathy Chepesky was allowed to read to you.
"Marlowe," my dad whispered gently as he grabbed my foot that stuck out the end of my bed and shook me awake. "Time to get up, son. We're on our way in 15 minutes. Up and at it." It was still dark outside. Dawn had yet to break, but from what I could see through my bedroom window, it was going to be a very bleak day. It was early Saturday morning in mid-February, 1973, and I was in my first year of high school at MVDHS. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew I couldn't stay in bed. I also knew I didn't want to stay in Barry's Bay much longer, living as if I was working in a lumber camp for next to no wages for the rest of my life either. I had agreed to help my dad and his brother, my uncle and namesake, though he was never christened Marlowe. It was a nickname he earned, given his love of that old Polish novelist, Joseph Conrad, who often used Marlowe as his fictional narrator. One of the earliest things I remember hearing about my dad's older and only brother, Uncle Marlowe, was that during the Great Depression, he had gotten that nickname after having read dozens of Conrad novels that seemed to cheer him up, and of which he wrote home to my dad endlessly. My dad said his brother had always been a rather quiet and at times morose teenager, until he decided he too wanted no part of the forest industry. So, late in 1929, when he was barely 20, he went off to sea, having apprenticed as a telegraph operator at the old railroad station in Barry's Bay. But instead of accepting a full-time job with CN, Uncle Marlowe accepted a job with the P&O steamship line and dedicated his entire working career to doing transatlantic runs as a radio telegraph operator. That was over 40 years ago, and my dad hadn't seen or heard much of his older brother since World War II, until about a month ago when he returned home after Christmas looking old and decrepit, except for a shock of thick white hair he carried with distinction, or as Dad used to say jokingly to him, like some Samson waiting for his Delilah. Uncle Marlowe had always been a strange duck, partly from spending all those years at sea, but more essentially, my dad thought, because 6 of those years were spent in the Canadian Navy on corvettes escorting cargo ships to England. It was a time when he saw more than his fair share of death and destruction brought on by German U-boats. My dad said his brother was always a bit of a strange duck, even before he left Barry's Bay. He kept to himself, was very bookish, and never quite got on with ordinary people. He especially didn't get along with my grandfather, his dad, who died in 1926 and who I knew only through stories my father told me. My grandfather had come over from Ireland in 1868 when he was a 10-year-old orphan and settled among some relatives on their rough scrabble farm on the Stone Road between Douglas and Admaston. But as with most teenage boys back then, he was soon sent to Skeed's Depot at Bark Lake to earn his living as a shantyman further upriver. The depot had been built in 1840 far up the Madawaska River by James and Robert Skeed, who went on to become Ottawa Valley lumber barons. James did so well for himself that Sir John A. Macdonald appointed him to the first Canadian Senate in 1867. But by that fall of 1872, the local economy had gone to hell, so my grandfather, 14 at the time, was sent to Skeed's Depot, and eventually, or so I was told, a lumber shanty further up the Opiongo. There he got free room and board and made enough cash to keep the farm going on the Stone Road. My dad used to tell me stories of those early pioneer days in the upper Madawaska and Opiongo River valleys. For the longest time, when I was a child, and, as they say, thought like a child, I wanted to be just like my grandfather, having wild bush adventures that sounded wonderful, and yet, the older I got, the more I thought there was something wrong with all those stories. Somehow I knew they weren't true, even though my father tried to convince me they were. They couldn't be true. Real people, I knew, would never behave like that, not really. Around Barry's Bay, life had always been hard, and it was undoubtedly much harder back when my grandfather was a kid. Call me cynical, but generally people are far more venal, having all the human failings and ordinary vices, than those people who existed in the stories my father told of my grandfather's carefree shanty days. It all sounded too much like some Disney movie. Even in grade school, all I had to do was look around the schoolyard. Children certainly had the capacity to be rational, decent, good. But the reality, especially in Barry's Bay, remained far different. It's a place, probably no worse than other places, but Barry's Bay was certainly no Disney paradise. Anybody with half a brain knows a lumber town is often brutal, nasty, and not for the weak at heart, nor the morally feeble. Still, I enjoyed my dad's stories, and whatever it was Uncle Marlowe had a problem with when he was a teenager, I was sympathetic to him. But he sounded like someone on the run, as if he were frightened of something. I never knew what that was, but I felt sorry that he had to leave Barry's Bay to escape whatever it was that wouldn't let him live a normal life here, or let him settle down and maybe get married and raise a family, perhaps somewhere close by. He was a lifelong bachelor, as far as I knew, so when he finally retired from his life as a transatlantic radio telegraph officer, he came back to Barry's Bay and reconnected with my dad and our family, which he quickly adopted as his own, but me especially. Perhaps it was my name, not a nickname, but a real name given to me by my father to remember his only brother who he thought was never coming home. So, for me, Uncle Marlowe was not just my namesake. It was as if I was somehow a reincarnation of somebody my father had once loved and thought he had lost. Perhaps, too, it was my age. My uncle said I reminded him of himself when he was my age. Or perhaps, and I hate to admit it, I too was considered a bit of a strange duck, having a tendency to have low expectations of my fellow man, or perhaps to run away from things I didn't understand. My mum saw it a little differently. She said I'd never run from anything. It's just that I never wanted to stand still. And to be clear, she said there was nothing serious I'd ever run from. If anything, she said, I was always running towards something, especially some imaginative future I sure as hell believed in somewhere other than Barry's Bay. Some impossible place, maybe my own make-believe Disneyland, even though I didn't know where it was, nor how to find it. Marlowe, stop your confounded daydreaming, shouted my dad, albeit with a big grin, as he caught me standing still by his half-ton, staring blindly and searching for the first sliver of morning light. Grab that confounded axe and the coal oil can of your grandfather's and that bit of rope. Pull the wool out and get a move on, for Christ's sake. So I piled into the sleigh, really my old toboggan with two makeshift sideboards, with all the things I was told to look after, so that I could be towed behind my dad's snowmobile and hold on for dear life. Uncle Marlowe led the way into the bush on his brand new yellow skidoo, after which my father followed on his old beat-up wreck he bought second-hand and somehow made to work. We had driven our half-ton with its makeshift snowmobile trailer up past Vic DeMillis's place atop Carson Lake and parked near the old Skuse farm along the Opiongo Road before heading south on our two snow machines. Once across Highway 60, where we stopped to admire the long-gone Bark Lake schoolhouse that once stood there and where my dad and Uncle Marlowe used to go to school as boys in the 1920s, we then plowed beneath a seemingly endless range of heavy tree branches, all laden with bales of hefty, sagging snow, and along what used to be a winding dirt road that worked its way towards what had once been Skeed's Depot out along Bell's Bay on Bark Lake. The land was rugged, topsy-turvy, and heavily overgrown, having been left derelict since the 30s. Occasionally, there were the graying remains of ancient log buildings that I could barely make out until my dad pointed them out and said they belonged to the Duns, the Pershaws, the Reeds, and about half a dozen other families I had heard about all my life. But that Disneyland that my dad and uncle knew as the Bark Lake Settlement, well, it looked more like a ghost town. In fact, it was so chaotically dispersed and overgrown it no longer resembled even one recognizable homestead. We traveled for what seemed like too long a time, so much so that I thought we surely had missed finding the old depot. Perhaps it was the speed at which my uncle was whipping along, breaking fresh trail through the deep snow, or perhaps it was the many twists and turns in the track that he left behind for us to follow, but he had me wondering if he was maybe not drunk from the night before. Oh, the slugging's pretty hard, my dad said after we had stopped by ourselves so he could relight his roll-your-own cigarette and check to see that I hadn't fallen out of the sleigh. I was tightly, if barely, jammed among three broad axes, loose rope, and that old red coal oil tin can that I could feel sloshing between my knees as we came to an abrupt stop after my dad shut off his engine and let it cool for a minute or two. Should be there shortly, was all he said before taking a few more puffs and again pulling the ripcord of his jerry-rigged snowmobile, painted over with red house paint. With a roar of his carefully loved engine and a waft of blue smoke, we headed off again. Eventually, we arrived at a clearing overlooking Bark Lake, perhaps 100 feet down below and under a rock outcropping that formed a deceptive ledge that no snowmobiler would ever want to approach at full speed. This is the place, shouted Uncle Marlowe before shutting off his machine with a surprising happy face. I'm certain of it. With that, he grabbed one of the three axes like some demon who didn't acknowledge that I was still stuck in the toboggan, and then struggling through the deep windswept drifts like somebody slogging through muskeg, he headed towards the tree line about 100 yards to the east. It was thick with hemlock, spruce, cedar, and some mighty red and white pines, along with a smattering of maple, poplar, and a few young oaks, that latter all denuded of their leaves and looking grim, as if spring might never arrive. Under a low ribbon of gray-silver sky that ran along the eastern horizon, the same color as the galvanized tin roof of the old Barry's Bay Arena, I watched as my uncle disappeared through the dark green veil of the forest with my father chasing not 20 feet behind him. Both had broad axes in hand, flailing above their heads to keep their balance among the shifting snowdrifts, made more perilous by the relentless raw wind coming off the lake. They looked less like two old men than two young boys on some happy-go-lucky adventure, not necessarily legal. I grabbed my axe, the red oil can, and rope, and followed their trail into the bush, which, in its early morning darkness, held a peculiar uneasy feeling as if it were somehow not a mid-February Saturday morning just at the break of dawn, but some other nameless day where time had ceased to register and had been replaced by something strangely fatal. Once inside the overgrown forest that hadn't been cut in 100 years, I stopped in near total darkness to listen. All I could hear was mad distant chopping, axes being wielded by a seemingly crazed man, and then a second axe flailing just as wildly, and then laughter, but not the sort to inspire belly laughs, rather a giddy, almost devilish laughter. I quickened my pace and ran as best I could through the deep snow until I caught sight of them, one on each side of a huge weathered oak, well over 120 feet high and easily 3 feet at the trunk, a tree that must have been 200 years old. Majestically, it stood in its own little clearing, curiously alone and singularly beautiful, as if it were meant to grow there forever in some hidden garden of wildflowers that no one was ever to know about or see. I marveled at the stupidity of it all. There were these two grown men, chopping and laughing like two crazed devils, wildly axing a tree that would take hours to fell when the job could have been done by a proper chainsaw in less than 15 minutes, and for no apparent reason. Had I been able to stop them from starting, I would have told them of the beauty they were destroying, but it was too late. What was the point, anyway? I raced to the base of that carbuncled old oak and grabbed my dad's shoulder. "Why are we chopping down this tree?" I shouted over the racket of my uncle, wielding his broad axe as he kept wildly swinging at the trunk. "Why didn't we bring the chainsaw?" "Later, later," was all my dad could muster, his lit cigarette still dangling from the right side of his frosted mustache and wiry smoke obscuring his eyes, before he himself went back to chopping, hoping to keep pace with his brother. It made no sense. Absolutely no sense, but I knew I had no choice. I also knew why I was there. I was to be their relief man. Whenever either man needed a break, I was to take over and let one rest for 15 minutes or so, and then the other. With an unusual burst of energy, especially for a 14-year-old, I too hit that old tree trunk like some crazed woodpecker, desperate to finish a job we all knew was too big for any single, double, or even triple entity. So I chopped like a madman when called upon. In fact, we all chopped for hours, till I thought my arms would fall off. When we were nearly through, my uncle pulled some wedges from his pack sack, packed them into the opposite side of the trunk, and after a few dozen more well-placed swings from each of us, my dad shouted the all clear. We then stood back to watch and listen in reverence to that most unique cracking of live wood, the creaking of old timber about to die. That majestic oak towering over us, leafless and gray, a mass of crooked and twisted branches, began its slow, agonizing descent to the snowdrifts below. It was both glorious and sad to see it fall, hear its muffled, thunderous thud that shook the ground beneath our gum-rubber boots, and feel the punch of its wind hit our jacketed chests. I can't say for sure, as all its leaves were gone, but as it lay there, it looked to be very much alive, as if it could still push forth from itself another set of fresh green leaves once spring arrived. I still didn't know why we were there or why we had to chop down this particular tree. Honestly, I didn't even know what we were going to do with it after it came down. We certainly didn't have time to limit entirely before nightfall, nor would we be able to haul all the wood out with only two snowmobiles and my old toboggan. I wanted to ask my dad, but he just kept his eyes on my uncle, who in turn refused to take his eyes off the old oak. He kept walking around it, looking for something in particular, as if he'd lost something in its branches. He kept tramping, circling, jumping over this branch and that, until he stopped and pointed to one huge, gnarly limb, about 30 feet long and about a foot in diameter, where it was attached to the trunk about 30 feet up from the ground when it was still standing. "That's it! That's it!" Uncle Marlowe yelled, adding a few expletives of a decidedly profane nature, known to local lumberjacks, if not old sailors. My father never batted an eyelash. He simply jumped towards the designated branch and began chopping, again as if a crazed man. It took another hour or so, but we cut and split that huge branch into a neat pile of short timbers that were stood up into a 6-foot teepee, a bonfire in the making. It was now well into the afternoon, if not starting to grow dark again. We had never stopped to have lunch, but with the teepee finished, all three of us sat down with our backs against the limbless section of the felled oak. And facing the teepee, my uncle pulled out a tea tin from his pack sack and proceeded to make a shantyman's bush lunch. He found no end of delight in starting a fire by dousing the kindling wood at the base of the teepee with the entire contents of my grandfather's coal oil canister. "There!" he shouted, his body half twisted towards the dying gray sky, already turning a dark metallic blue, like the barrel of some well-polished gun. And with a giddy, insane smile curling his lips and his beard still covered in hoarfrost, I could swear I heard him whisper, "That should end it, once and for all." My father just shrugged his shoulders when I looked at him for explanation. "In time, Marlowe, in time," he mumbled towards me, as if not to disturb his brother's reverie. Eventually, I did get an explanation. After we finished our toast and tea and some shanty hardtack that my uncle unexpectedly brought along with him, and which he said my grandfather had shown him how to make, my uncle lit a roll-your-own cigarette, took a long, merciless drag, and slowly blew smoke rings into the quiet air. He also pulled out a Mickey and passed it to my dad, who refused, made a joke of passing it to me, and then over the next hour drank the whole thing himself, as we all just watched the center of the fire and tried to keep warm as the sweat inside our long johns had turned cold now that we were all at rest. Nobody seemed in a hurry to do anything, but eventually Uncle Marlowe began to talk. But to no one in particular, not to me, not to my father, only maybe insanely to my grandfather, for it was only him that it would have made any sense to be talking to. Or maybe he was just talking to the fire. "You old bastard. You couldn't keep it to yourself. You just couldn't keep your goddamn mouth shut. Not to them, not to me. Okay, so you were 14. That's no excuse. A boy at 14 in a lumber camp has to be as much of a man as he'll ever be. Why couldn't you just shut?" Here he added another one of those local profanities known to old lumberjacks and sailors. "Up and keep quiet, and keep all of us safe and sane. Why did you have to tell me, me of all people, when I was only 14? My uncle then went silent, but the look on his face made me think he was having a stroke or a heart attack. Suddenly he turned catatonic. "Dad," I shouted, "what the hell?" I was lifting off into panic mode, but my dad stood up, moved over beside me, and put an arm around me, held me close, and made me sit down again. "Don't worry," he said with a warm smile. "It's something he has to get through. I only found out about it after I gave your mother her St. Valentine's Day chocolates yesterday. He didn't have to say anything more. I had been there for supper, and though it had always been a goofy tradition with my father to give my mum chocolates, never flowers, Uncle Marlowe happened to be at the dinner table. He turned stone cold white at the mention of St. Valentine's Day. He had to get up and leave the table. And I never saw him again until after my dad woke me up and I went outside to load the snowmobiles. With my uncle still looking unwell, just staring into the fire, he soon took on an ever-changing expression. His face seemed to drift between profound distress and profound sadness. After a too long silence, my dad began talking. You know the story of your grandfather going to work in the lumber camps when he was 14? I nodded my head. Well, there's a bit more to it than what I thought I knew until last night, my dad continued. I still don't know the whole story, but last night your uncle told me what he was told by your grandfather when apparently I was too young to be told. Or maybe I guess your grandpa didn't have a chance to because I was only 10 when he died, and maybe he thought I was too young to hear such a story. Anyway, you know your grandfather was born in 1858 and didn't marry until he was 50. It's an Irish thing, marrying that late, my dad chuckled to himself. Well, anyway, in 1909 your Uncle Marlowe was born, and then your two aunts, and then I came along in 1915. I was never told that story about what really happened that first winter here at Skeeds until last night. I still don't know if I believe it all, but your uncle swears by it and has lived with it since 1923, when he first heard it on St. Valentine's Day, 50 years to the day after it happened. Well, it seems on St. Valentine's Day, 1873, 100 years ago to the day before I gave your mother those chocolates, your grandfather was involved in something that he and your uncle both devoutly wished they were never a part of. It was at that point Uncle Marlowe finally came to, and eventually, when he understood what my father was saying, he took over telling the story again, not so much telling it to us as seemingly reliving that day when his father told him. Brett was one of those fellows who just had to tease and bully and belittle anyone younger or smaller than himself until he made you feel smaller and weaker every time he dealt with you, began my uncle. He was at Skeeds working as a blacksmith's helper. He never had the brains to become a real blacksmith himself, but McGregor, the walking boss, had no place else to put him. He didn't get along with most everybody in camp, except the occasional drunkard like himself who used to send out to the settlement where they could buy high wines and bring them back to camp, which was not legal at all, at all. No booze was ever allowed in Skeed shanties, but they could never catch Brett. He was smart enough for that, but not for much else. Well, on St. Valentine's Day, he starts teasing his favorite Mark, a young teamster, a good if simple kid from Killaloo, a lad named Kane, at first on account of his name, and then Brett began tormenting him, saying dirty, disgusting things about Kane's young sister and what he was going to do to her if they ever got her alone on St. Valentine's Day. Well, Kane couldn't take it anymore, and though he was only maybe 7 stone, no one would ever consider him a fighting man. Well, Kane beat the living daylights out of Brett. So much so that Brett took to his bunk, moaning, saying he'd broken a rib. Eventually, the bunkhouse quietens down after lights out. But somewhere in the middle of the night, Brett, not that hurt at all, but he must have kept up his drinking on the sly. And so he gets up in the darkest hour, and he grabs one of the cookie's butcher knives for cutting pork bellies and goes over to Kane's bunk. And while the young lad's fast asleep, he stabs Kane. All hell breaks loose, said my uncle, his eyes suddenly widening as if he himself was at Skeeds that night and long before he was ever born. It took more than a few minutes to get the coal oil lanterns lit, and so only when there was enough light did they see that Brett was still stabbing Kane. By the time anybody could pull Brett off, Kane breathed his last. As my uncle stared into the heart of the oak fire, his face held an expression that wasn't anything I've ever seen on any other person before or since. I really don't know how to explain or describe it, but when the wind rose up and rustled the pines nearby, he went on. What could anybody do? There was no law, no justice of the peace. They were back in the bush, for God's sake, 100 miles from anywhere. They didn't even have a jail to throw Brett into until the law might eventually show up in a couple of weeks. And even if they did, nobody expected to be able to hold Brett that long. He was too smart for that. So the crew did what any shanty crew might do under the circumstances. They tied Brett to the cook's deacon bench and took turns guarding him through the rest of the night while everybody else stayed up. Nobody could sleep, even though Saturday was a work day and they had to work till noon at the very least. So they all stayed up, talking and trying to figure this thing out. By noon, there came a solution from an unexpected place. 4 men had stood guard over Brett, who continued to sneer at them and belittle Kane or anyone else who thought he was man enough to do anything about him killing that little weasel, as Brett called him. Brett said he alone was the only fellow in camp who was man enough to mete out real justice, and so Kane got his. In a strange way, it was Brett himself who proposed to have a trial and either convict him or let him go about his business, promising that if he was acquitted, he'd leave Skeeds and be gone forever, and probably go back to the States and never darken their Canadian backwoods doorway again. A smile rippled across Uncle Marlowe's face. It was Brett who set his own fate in motion. My father looked at me as if he didn't believe what my uncle was saying, smoke from the fire forcing his eyes to drop to his teacup, while he softly shook his head, whispering to no one in particular, "Man, oh man." So out of maybe 100 men in camp that Saturday, with the walking boss gone upriver, 12 men self-selected, with Brett himself even suggesting some who made up the jury. Yet nobody wanted to sit as judge, though the group had no trouble finding 2 fellows who wanted to play at being lawyers. One, a friend of Kane's, acted as the Crown prosecutor, and the other, a friend of Brett, sobered himself up long enough to play at being his defense counsel. The judge, my uncle stumbled, almost breaking into tears, turned out to be the only person in camp who couldn't say no, as everybody else had done. At first, again, I didn't understand, and the expression on my face must have made itself known to my father. As my uncle poked at the fire and said nothing for the longest time, I turned quizzically to my father, who silently mouthed 2 words that made everything plain. "Your grandfather." What else could a 14-year-old immigrant orphan boy do? What else could anyone his age do? Repeated my uncle before again sinking into silence for the longest time before abruptly starting up again. So they had a trial of sorts, and in a matter of 15 minutes, that's all it took, the jury voted. They didn't vote secretly. The foreman didn't need to stand up all alone to voice the verdict. The whole goddamn jury shouted out unanimously, even Brett's friends, including his lawyer, guilty as charged. Every blasted one of them, some even cackled. One with an insane giddy laugh just kept laughing uncontrollably. The whole bunkhouse then turned to a 14-year-old boy. What could he do? Certainly he didn't understand what the jury egged him on to do. So he did what he was told and passed sentence. Brett was to be hung from this here oak tree until he was in the same state of being as Kane, whose body lay not 10 feet away still in his bunk as rigor mortis set in. Justice was to be meted out, an eye for an eye. Just before he died, Uncle Marlowe said of his own father, He told me somebody had given him high wines to make a man out of him, right after he started throwing up when he first saw Cain's bloody body. They poured more into him to convince him to be man enough to be the judge. And so he said he had gotten progressively drunk and was flying high during those 15 minutes of the trial. He said by the time he passed sentence, he was laughing, but honestly thought it was some kind of joke, a St. Valentine's Day prank to scare him, as some of the men had already done to him at Christmas and in the first month of his being there the autumn before. So he just played along, thinking it was all play acting, some kind of joke. It was no joke, said my uncle, a bitter, sour taste seeming to invade his mouth, his lips bubbling with spittle as he spoke. Brett was taken to this tree. My dad brought me up here and showed it to me the summer before he died. And a rope was thrown over that branch, he said, nodding towards the bonfire. A teamster from Killaloe who sat on the jury volunteered one of his own horses, and five or six men brought Brett out of the bunkhouse and sat him upright with his hands tied behind his back. A noose made by the blacksmith was looped around Brett's neck, and before your grandpa could sober up, half a dozen lumberjacks whacked the rump of that horse, and Brett swung free, kicking but not so much as screaming. There was only an ungodly gurgle coming from his throat, and his eyes bulged. Finally, the kicking stopped. The tongue turned purple and stuck out, and then stiffened. All the while, Dad said he was laughing, thinking they were going to cut him down after teaching him a good lesson, and they'd all get on with their lives and go back to work. Instead, Dad never worked another day for Skeeds, nor did any of the men involved. They were all fired, shunned, and talked about behind their backs. In March, two detectives from Perth eventually came up, but nobody said a thing. Instead, the bunkhouse crew said they had heard something like that once happened down in Abinger Township in Lennox and Addington, but certainly nothing like that could ever happen at Bark Lake. Old McGregor, the walking boss, told those Perth detectives that if it had, he would have known. And besides, Brett never came back after Christmas, and he thought he was now back in the States, causing trouble for someone else, and good riddance. For the longest time, my dad and uncle then remained silent, just listening to the sound of the fire crackling and the pines rustling from the giddy wind. Finally, my uncle spoke on for the last time. Most people wouldn't hold a 14-year-old responsible, but some did and still do. There are always people who want to bully, to take advantage of another human being, especially if they just want to remain as quiet as an Indian. It was a curious thing to say, as quiet as an Indian. Long before that day, my dad had told me Uncle Marlowe, on account of his dark complexion, black hair, brown eyes, and habit of not speaking much when spoken to as a teenager, was often teased and asked if he was an Algonquin off the reserve. With that last comment, the story ended. My uncle stopped talking. So too did my dad. We all just sat there for maybe an hour or more until the old oak fire burnt itself out. And as it did, I began to understand why my uncle had a reputation for being morose after he turned 14, and why he had to do what he did in 1929, and why my father had to help him chop down that blasted tree 100 years to the day. And why I needed to tell this story when I saw again that clipping from the Chicago Tribune that I hadn't read in years. My father had it in his things. I found it when he died. It belonged to my grandfather. My uncle then inherited it as his oldest child, or maybe he just wanted to keep it from the rest of the family. And then my dad, the youngest, finally got it when Uncle Marlowe died. And then it came down to me, his only child. Last night, I read it one last time and burnt it.
That was Kathy Chepesky reading The Mystery of Skeed's Oak, a local story by an author who chooses to remain anonymous. And that's all we're allowed to say at this time. But stay tuned. We're told the next spare board to be released by the Station Keepers MV will have more details about that infamous 1873 Chicago Tribune news article. So, if you's just got to know, better sign up to get that spare board lickety-split. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for Kathy Chepesky and our very scary producer, Barry Conway, we hope you have a very safe Halloween. But do stay away from those old, twisted, carbuncled, and leafless oak trees up there along Skeeds Road overlooking Bark Lake. Good day, and God bless.